This episode of the Slate Spoiler Special is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/slate.
Hi, I'm Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with the Slate Spoiler Special podcast on Jane Eyre, the new 2011 version, directed by Cary Fukunaga and starring Mia Wasikowska. It's a lot of syllables so far. And Michael Fassbender. Joining me here in the studio is Lizzie Skernick. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Dana.
Do you want to introduce yourself as far as what you do? Blogger, writer, critic extraordinaire?
Done. Yeah. I'll mention my book because my publisher likes it. I'm the author of Shelf Discovery, a memoir about teen reading.
Which is actually kind of perfect for
totally.
For
this. It doesn't have Jane Eyre, but it could.
Well, Jane Eyre is essentially the 1810 version of same, right? Or no, everybody's going to write in that I got completely the wrong date. When was Jane Eyre written?
I had 1810 in my brain, too.
Wait, I happen to have my it's missing its entire back, my very old paperback here.
Oh, 1847.
So we saw this together yesterday. We agreed that we would not exchange a word about it till we got into the studio. But overall, good impression? Bad impression?
I loved it. Right up until the end, I enjoyed the entire thing. I had no intention of loving it, but I just loved it.
I sort of went in slightly prejudiced against it because I just don't feel like I need a fresh Jane Eyre at the moment. I'm totally fine with William Hurt and Charlotte Gainsbourg for the next decade, which, as I remember, I should re-see it before I write on this movie tomorrow. But as I remember, I really liked that version. I thought the casting was fantastic. I don't think there's yet been a great film made of Jane Eyre, and it's maybe hard to film a great book. This is sort of an ongoing, discussion. Whether a great work of literature can be made into a great movie. But there have been a lot of serviceable, fun, kind of romantic gothic adaptations. And I thought Charlotte Gainsbourg was one of the best Jane Eyres I've ever seen.
I can't speak to that because I've never seen that version. I think the last one I saw, what was the version that came out in like 1939? What version would that? It's probably not.
Well, I mean, I only know of two other versions. I think it's been filmed many times, and I think there have been like BBC kind of adaptations too. But there's the Orson Welles, Joan Fontaine.
That's the last
and,
one. I saw.
And the very young Elizabeth Taylor as Helen Burns, the girl in Lowood Institution at the beginning.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Which I also don't remember as a great movie. I mean, definitely the casting of Orson Welles as Rochester didn't work at all. It was one of those kind of grotesque stunt casting Orson Welles moments.
Right. Right. I agree. Well, I think what was interesting, though, about this version is that it was so gothic. I mean, right from the beginning, because I had forgotten, I know we just crammed on our literary Jane Eyres. What a friendly, funny book that is. And that this really, that scene right at the beginning where she's whacked on the head with the book and, I guess he's her first cousin actually, is looking for her with a knife. That there's so much abuse, but quick abuse in these first passages that you completely forget that the book itself actually elides that. I mean, it doesn't refer to pain at all.
Yeah, the movie opens on a very grim note. It seems like the unrelenting message of the first 15 minutes or so when she's a child, when instead of being played by Mia Wasikowska, she's played by a child actress.
Right.
The message is, this period, 1810 or whatever it was, the early 1800s was a time of child abuse as a kind of just a ritual practice.
And penitence. I kept thinking the words penitent, actually, at the beginning, because right at the front, she's lying on those dead rocks on the heath, or on the moors, really.
Oh, yeah. We should talk about the time frame, actually, because there's some funny time cutting. We do start out with Mia Wasikowska grown up, right? And she's running away in tears on this gothic heath from something we know not what, which it turns out later on is she's running away from the truth that she learned about Rochester, right? But that's all sort of takes place out of time. And then we go back to her childhood and kind of see a setup of how screwed she's been since birth.
Right.
So in case people don't know the story of Jane Eyre, so basically we're going to sort of be mingling stuff from the book and the movie here, but essentially she's an orphan, right, who starts out in the care of her very cold, rich aunt, played by Sally Hawkins, interesting, a big actress for a very small part. And this woman treats her horribly and eventually
aunt sends, by marriage.
By marriage, right. Yeah. So the guy who actually loved her, the uncle, is gone, dead. And then she gets sent to the Lowood Institution, which in the book is a really significant portion of the book and one of my favorite parts of the book. It gets pretty curtailed in the movie. But the Lowood Institution is, a very grim orphanage where she befriends another young girl named Helen Burns, the one that Liz Taylor played in the old movie. And that also gets a to something very small here. I love the character of Helen Burns and that whole part in the book, and it seems very crucial to the book.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it would have to make for an 8-hour-long movie probably to include all of this stuff. What did you think of the Lowood stuff at the beginning?
Well, I loved it because in the way that the movie is spare and very witty, it's also spare and very witty. I love the part where they make her stand on the chair. And what does he say? He says, "This is your pedestal of infamy."
Right.
And that's the only thing we hear from that instructor, you know. And the only thing we see from the mistress of the house is her pulling off her fine dress and having her step out of it. So I loved that. I just felt like it was a very particular interpretation. I mean, I felt like the entirety of this movie was a very particular spare interpretation of the book. You know, the only thing we see from what's her friend's name again? I can't remember.
Helen
any
Burns
names today. Oh yeah, Helen Burns. The only thing we see is she gives her a role when she's on her pedestal of infamy, and then she dies. So that's pretty much it. And in a way, I liked that though because it's one of the few moments of sentiment. That scene and the end are practically the only sentimental moments in the film, and it's almost as if the filmmaker. I mean, we can get to this a little bit later, but since we only see Jane Eyre from the outside.
Whereas in the book, she's a first-person narrator, right?
Totally, an endlessly first-person narrator. I mean, she's really sort of full. And this Jane, we only see from the point of view of Rochester, of everybody else, and from her answers to things, which are very clever. But because he's taken that out, it's almost as if he has to stay very spare or she's going to be sentimental whether or not he wants her to be. You know,
well, the thing that makes Jane Eyre hard to adapt, I think, is that the entire story of Jane Eyre rests on the fact that everyone good who meets Jane Eyre loves Jane Eyre, right? So it would be really easy for her to be a goody two-shoes. But in the book, she's not at all a goody two-shoes.
No.
But Helen Burns, right? I mean, she's in all these horrible institutions where there's no love and no thinking and no laughter. And she's actually this very thoughtful person who always wants to engage in these debates about, right, you know, theology and freedom with everyone she meets. And whether it's Helen Burns at the institution or Rochester later on or even St. John, St. John, you know,
yes,
the preacher who decides that he wants to marry her at one point, everybody kind of elevates her as this exceptional being. And in the book, that makes sense because we hear her language, which is
right,
exceptional, and we sort of engage with her ourselves. In the movie, it's very easy for her to become this sort of
cipher.
Yeah,
cipher.
And sort of a wimpy, passive victim. I think this movie did a pretty good job of avoiding that. I have to say, I think the Charlotte Gainsbourg one did a better job.
Well, here she's, you know, it did sort of emphasize the idea of her being small and plain. I mean, I think she says that. That's one of the lines that's included.
But isn't that a problem for you, too, a little bit? I mean, this is the classic Hollywood problem, but Mia mm-hmm. Wasikowska is small, but she's certainly not plain.
She's not plain, although I do think the hairstyle, so I do think she looks plain enough, actually, in this role, the way it's played, and certainly compared to the sort of, you know, Bird of Paradise way all the other girls are dressed, you know, the wealthier girls. And even the sisters, even St. John's sisters, are better curled and shiny haired. So I do think, in comparison, she looks sort of burlappy and plain enough, you know. And even on her wedding day, she's so, I mean, I think this is the way Mia, I can never say her last name, Wasikowska, mm-hmm. plays her. She's so flat-chested and buttoned up that actually works for her being small and plain. But I do think the part that's difficult is our not getting, you know, I do think the director must have struggled. Of course, in this spare Gothic version, he doesn't want to do a voiceover because then all of a sudden it's like, you know, some movie version of The Turn of the Screw. But then how are we supposed to understand Jane Eyre as this brave character except for the two or three clever ways she resists Rochester?
That's why it's really hard for me to tell with a movie like this how much I'm bringing to it. I really enjoyed this movie and I actually at many moments thought, oh, that was, you know, that scene was really well played. That character mm-hmm. was really well sketched. But I have no idea how much of it I was bringing from the book. And I think if I was coming to it cold, it might seem a little bit cipher-like, the big romance. But let's talk her into her next stage of life.
Okay.
So she runs away from the Lowood Institution, mm-hmm. makes her way through the heath, and ends up cold and wet randomly at the door of this local pastor, I guess.
Curate, I think. That's
yeah, curate. That was the word I was looking for.
I can't believe I remember that.
That's an excellent word. I was actually thinking of the French curé, and then, like, there's not a word in
no,
English,
yeah.
but there is.
Yeah, curate.
So he's played by Jamie Bell. His name's St. John, and he's actually quite a good character, I think, really well developed in the movie.
Sure.
They keep her for a while, and then they find her work as a governess at this forbidding manor called Thornfield, run by Rochester, who, you know, becomes the big love interest in the second half of the movie.
No, she's found work. I only remember this just because the movie is so confusing. St. John finds her that free work as the teacher for
oh,
the
yeah,
girls
in the
village.
Oh, yeah, there's a very, very brief and not, I don't think, very well-developed moment where she is a teacher and then we don't know exactly why she leaves.
She's found the job with Rochester. That's her placement from the school. So remember that back scene where all the girls are saying goodbye to her at Longwood,
right.
which is the other way we understood she's very loved because all the younger girls love her and are saying goodbye to her. Then from there, she's placed with Rochester. And then when she runs from Rochester, she winds up on St. John's door and he finds her that low placement. His sisters go off to their placement, and then he finds her that placement, and he says, I haven't wanted to tell you because it's so very low, you'll just be teaching village girls. And she's like, anything, just get me the hell away from Rochester. And so then she winds up at that village school alone. But then it's St. John at that school who tells her she's inherited all the money. And then that's when she goes and lives with St. John. And then when he says, will you marry me? She, you know, spoiler, she goes off and goes back to Rochester. And I do think we should say, I've now looped incredibly, but that the Heath itself, something particular about this for those used to these English adaptations, which I loved, is that I almost wouldn't call it the Heath. It's like the Badlands. I mean, it's this enormous barren landscape. I actually wonder where they found it, you know, whether it's in England or whether it's in Wales or somewhere.
I wondered that too. Did you see the last Harry Potter movie? Because there's a lot of crazy landscape that doesn't look English at all.
It's like
looks
New
a
Zealand.
Lot like this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it must be because it's not like I've traveled England extensively, but I've never seen anything that looks like that there. And I felt like that was the first signal to us from the director that this was going to be a hugely barren Arctic movie.
Yeah, well, that should be something to alert listeners to, is that this is not a Merchant Ivory feeling movie.
No.
It's not kind of crammed with soundtrack and costume and, you know, lush period detail and things like that. I mean, the period detail all seems accurate, but it seems like there's an attempt to empty that out and give it a more airy feeling.
Oh, totally. It's very – even the light is sort of spectral and washed out, you know, which I thought was so interesting because I wrote on my notes also not Merchant Ivory, like underlined three times, because those movies are so warm. They're all about the, you know, overwhelming plenitude of the
past.
Of
right.
the past. And this movie is really about its darkness. I mean, it literally begins with her hiding behind that white curtain trying to read a book and then this guy slamming her on the head so blood runs from her. It's not your mother's 19th century.
Well, we have to get to the romance, which is the heart of the movie, and the relationship between Rochester and Jane. But first, let's take a break for a word from our sponsor. This episode of the Spoiler Special is brought to you by Squarespace.com. So Squarespace is a place that you can create a website to display your Flickr photos, create a blog, stream your tweets and your RSS feeds, design, color choice, you know, customize the whole thing. It offers a lot more options than free hosting sites like Blogspot, which basically require you to get your web designer friend to come help you make it actually look good. And you can try it out today for free through a special offer with the podcast. On their site, they show you some of the kinds of websites that you can build through Squarespace, and they also have an iPhone app, which makes it very easy to update your info on the go. Squarespace.com/slate. Go there to sign up for a free trial, no credit card needed, and thank you, Squarespace, for your support. All right, so here we are halfway through our discussion of Jane Eyre, and we haven't talked about the Rochester-Jane Eyre romantic connection yet, which is, especially in the movie, is the heart of the thing, right?
Right.
I mean, the book may be about free will and friendship and all kinds of other things, but, I mean, every movie adaptation of Jane Eyre has basically been a gothic romance about this gloomy, impenetrable guy, Rochester, and how
right.
she wins him over. So one key thing, what did you think of the casting and the chemistry with Michael Fassbender and Mia?
I loved the casting. I loved the chemistry. And what was so interesting to me is everybody's idea of Rochester. If you say Rochester, you always get the idea of this, you know, that's in the dictionary, gloomy, impenetrable. But this Rochester actually is just sort of dissolute and seeking connection always, you know, come talk to me, you know, amuse me, you know, so vibrant and active. And even though Jane is scared of him, you don't get this sense of this person that you couldn't reach ever, even before he declares his love. And I actually loved that about him because
he's not terribly broody, actually.
No.
You're right. I mean, William Hurt, definition of brooding, right? And Orson Welles, too.
Yeah. He's cranky. I mean, he's always, you know, there's that part where he goes off and shoots his gun and stuff, but he's quite present. You know, if you were his governess, you really would have a hard time not tumbling into his bed all the time.
Well, also because of the three Rochesters we're talking about, Michael Fassbender is by far the best looking, right?
Yeah, he's super, super hot. And also,
have you seen him in other things?
No.
Because see, the minute that I heard Michael Fassbender was in this, I kind of snapped to attention. Like, I just hope we get to see a lot of him. Well, you didn't see Fish Tank, which you should really, really see. It's one of the best movies of last year, and it really disappeared. It's this English kind of kitchen sink realist kind of movie where he plays this, I don't know how to describe it. I don't want to give too much away about his character, whether he's a good guy or a bad guy, but he becomes the object of obsession of this young 15-year-old girl. And he's so sexy in that movie. It's unbelievable. He's so good and menacing and sort of, you're not sure what to think of him, but you're incredibly drawn to him, and which is exactly how this young girl character thinks of him. And he was also in Inglourious Basterds in this small but hilarious role as the British spy, who was just like something out of an old Alec Guinness movie or something. You didn't see that either?
No, I'm like the worst. Never have me for a podcast again, because I'm like the worst movie podcast companion.
No, it's not that you have to come with knowledge. I just wanted to know if you had any Fassbender
priors. No, I had none, and that I actually sort of loved that about him, because I was absolutely new to him but not new to Rochester. And so
he sort of looks like a young Kevin Kline, except more with a darker, like not as sweet, you know, a little more edgy and menacing.
To me, I kept thinking, was he Joaquin Phoenix after, you know, 3 weeks at a spa or something? But I just, I mean, it's funny. You would think who they would have cast for Rochester. Who's the guy that plays the James Bond now?
Daniel Craig.
You know, he's sort of your more typical idea of an English Rochester, you know, truly menacing and brooding. You know, this Rochester just truly seems damaged. And it's very unclear if he's a liar or not. You know, when we get to the point where he...
Oh, well, we have to spoil the big spoiler in Jane Eyre. Which, if you've read, you already know. But it's the mad woman in the attic, right?
Yes.
It's the fact that Rochester, who slowly falls in love with his governess Jane and proposes to her, and they're at the altar about to get married, then it's revealed that all these strange scrapings and howlings that have been heard around the house,
which are
not
terrifying.
In fact, which are kind of ghostly,
yeah.
are not in fact a servant having a bad dream as he's been trying to pass it off, but his former wife who has gone crazy and he can't divorce her, and so she's locked up in an attic and she's
well, he
caged up there.
Well, he doesn't want to put her in a mental institution because those are horrible, and he says that to Mia. But what I thought was interesting again, though, in this movie, it's not just ghostly rattles. Remember, the two things we see of her is that she sets his bed on fire. She tries to kill him. And also that she wounds her brother quite deeply. You know, she cuts his neck almost to the bone. So she's not just she's truly the mad woman in the attic. The movie doesn't just sort of act like she's an inconvenience, you know. By the way, have you read Wide Sargasso Sea?
No.
Okay, so
it's a retelling of the story, right?
It's about their early marriage in Jamaica. And it's a wonderful...
The Jean Rhys novel.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful, dreamy, brooding book. And what I loved about this movie, I have no idea if the director read it, is that was her. You know, she's, you know, sort of like a really insane Creole, you know, seductive, who's now also become mad. And Wide Sargasso Sea is about the process of this fairly normal girl becoming that way. And I loved it that she was that kind of a mad woman. You know, she was quite... Jamaica was really a part of this movie. In a way that it is a part of the novel, but it's not a part of the novel the way it became a character in this movie.
Right. Have we addressed the gothic and that the book isn't gothic? Do we talk about that?
No, let's talk about that.
Maybe we'll wrap up with that. And, I wanted to mention Judi Dench, too, because I think she's great.
Yeah, I loved Judi Dench's funny surprise walk-on. I mean, because it was a screening, it's that kind of thing where you want to burst into applause, like when Alec Guinness sometimes comes onto the screen and you didn't know he was there. But, you know, but I couldn't. But she was quite wonderful.
As the housekeeper, yeah,
yes.
She was fantastic. I all the small roles were great. I mean, basically, I don't think that this movie breaks any new cinematic ground, but there's nothing wrong with it as a Jane Eyre adaptation.
No. And I also think it's interesting because I kept also thinking of what was that Nicole Kidman movie that was based on The Turn of the Screw?
Oh, The Others. I love that movie.
See, I loved
that. That's my favorite Nicole Kidman role, I think.
Oh, really?
Back when she really was an exciting actress to watch. You know?
Yeah. Nicole Kidman and The Others, to me, was sort of an example of Gothic going slightly over the top, you know, Gothic leaning on Gothic in order to be scary. Whereas what was interesting about this movie is how it added this minor Gothic to a book that's not Gothic at all. So we have that early scene where she's locked in the Red Room, which I guess was the first mention of Red Room ever before Stephen King, you know, and that terrible stuff comes out of the fire, you know, and we have the violent wailing from the mad woman. And we also just have her being caned, you know, which is awful. And then Jane being muttered in her head. But all the Gothic occurs on such a minor scale that it's actually much scarier. You would expect an entirely different book had you never read Jane Eyre and you only saw this movie. You would expect something more like Duras the Lover or something. And I think that's actually the one flaw in the ending, because this particular movie, in a way, can't have a happy ending. You know, it's not a happy movie. Everything about it is about misery, degradation, you know, self uh, keeping oneself unsatisfied. And then all of a sudden when she gets Rochester at the end, you're like, shouldn't Rochester have died?
Do you want to just summarize the end?
Oh, sure. At the end, Jane, after rejecting St. John, comes back to Rochester and the house is burned down. And Judi Dench is there, strangely enough. You know, she's wandering through for a while when we don't really know whether or not there's going to be anyone there, whether she's going to be able to find Rochester again. Judi Dench comes upon her and then she asks Judi Dench, where is he? At which point I thought she was going to point him towards a grave, you know. And then, of course, he's just sitting there kind of skinny, you know, and blind, but fine with the dog.
Not disfigured as he is in the other movie versions, because it's Michael Fassbender. He's just, his eyes look a little bit loopy, but basically it's him. And so, yeah, it is a happy ending within the very gloomy confines of this world.
Right.
Right. She's going to be with him after all. There's a redemption to their love. He's kind of blind and disfigured. And at the end of the book, there's almost a sense that she's his nursemaid or something.
That's what I was about to say. That's what makes more sense in the context really of either both works, is that after he's been forced to take care of his wife, you know, in this horrible compromised way, she would be forced to take care
of him. So it's like
Ethan
Frome. It's sort of like, yes, you get what you asked for and then it's horrible.
Exactly.
But the movie doesn't really leave you with that impression.
No. The movie leaves you with the impression of, thank God she didn't take St. John up on that offer to go to India. You know, like it's much more sort of a Jane Eyre, after sticking to her guns the entire time, is redeemed, you know, which is a nice story, but it doesn't seem like it's really the story of the aesthetics of this movie.
Here's a last question. Would you send friends to this movie if they're not Jane Eyre fans and English literature nuts? Would you just send somebody because it's a good movie?
Yeah, I would. I was attentive the entire time. I felt like it told the story well without it having to be a story that was familiar to anyone. Until the end, I thought it was just sort of gripping, which is strange since it's a story that is familiar to everybody.
Yeah, I would agree. All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming to see this movie with me, and please come see another one soon.
Oh, yeah. Any minute.
Our producer is Krishnan Vasudevan. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.